Lecture 12, Euripides, Bacchae.
In our last lecture, we explored the Oresteia of Aeschylus, that one surviving example of a complete trilogy of Athenian tragedy, the three plays that were put on together as part of one day-long performance in the Athenian democracy of the 5th century BC. And we explored it from the point of, what is fate? Are we fated to carry out the actions we do in life, or do we have self-will? And as we saw, that's one of the fundamental decisions that every thoughtful person comes to. Am I just a helpless victim of fate, or do I determine my own destiny? What do you think? You think you determine your own destiny? Well, as we saw, that was the lesson of the Oresteia. Yes, you make those choices. Even though the gods may set it up to look very tempting to make a choice, you actually make the choice, and you are responsible for the consequences that follow. This same theme of fate is at the heart of one of the most profound of all the Athenian tragedies, the Bacchae of Euripides. And like the Oresteia, the Bacchae ask the question, are there absolute values? Is there absolute good? Is there absolute truth? Or does everything depend upon circumstances and perception? In fact, does that go to the very question of, is there a God? And what is divine? Euripides is a characteristic example of the intellectual fervor of the Athenian democracy of the 5th century BC. Remember, that is the first government in history based upon the ideal of the greatest good for the greatest number of citizens. It is based upon an ideal of freedom as freedom to live your life as you choose. And the Athenian democracy embodied a set of values which we would accept today. A free market economy, the right to live as you choose, a tolerant lifestyle. We do not blame someone, the great Athenian statesman Pericles said, if they have a lifestyle we disagree with. We don't even give them sour looks that may hurt their feelings. You're free to live as you choose, and you have a set of individual rights protected by the law. And it was literally government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And the Athenian drama, the tragedy, was the characteristic cultural statement of the Athenian democracy. It was their public forum in which every Athenian citizen, and these were only males, attended. They received a stipend to come to the public performance, and in which they debated questions of the most profound moral consequence, because the Athenian democracy believed that there is no political decision that does not have a moral dimension. And just unless you want to blame the Athenians too much, you must remember that citizenship was dependent upon being able to serve in the army. The Athenian army was a completely citizen army. Women could not serve in the army, hence they were not citizens. And after all, you must also remember that when our democracy came into being in the Constitution, could women vote? No. In fact, women could not even vote at the time of the Civil War, could they? So the Athenians must be seen within their own context as the first democracy in history. And every spring, they came together to hold a dramatic festival in honor of the god Dionysus. These were the tragic performances, and they were put on in what we would call March, the spring of the year. They were a religious ceremony dedicated to the god Dionysus. They were held in a magnificent theater, and the play consisted generally of three actors and a chorus. And the chorus represented traditional, conventional wisdom, generally with the theme of moderation. Push nothing to excess. The Athenian democracy, this burst of freedom, unleashed a cultural creativity which has as a parallel, I think, only our own day in the world of 21st century, in which technology and science is transforming the world. And why are people more creative than ever before today? It is because they were free. And in Athens, freedom unleashed a questioning of all values. It was in 5th century Athens, the democracy, that the first history was written. It was there that scientific medicine began. And there that men question every value, every traditional value. There were a whole class of men in Athens who came there from all over the Greek world, the sophists or professors. And their job was to educate young Athenians. And they were paid high salaries. In fact, to study under a good sophist cost about the same as to go to Harvard today, translated into our own currency. And their duty was, one, to teach your son to speak well, because the art of oratory and persuasion was the key to political success in the Athenian democracy. But their goal was also to make them, what we would say, think critically. So your son would come home from studying with a sophist, and you would be sitting around the table, and you would say, well, what do you learn? And he would say, well, there is no absolute right and there's no absolute wrong. What do you mean there's no absolute right and absolute wrong? There's absolute right and truth. Is there, Dad? Or do circumstances just make something true? Is it just your perception of something? What do you mean? Well, Dad, you know the story about the ruler of Persia? No. Well, he had just the same question. So he called in a group of Indians from India, and he said, how much would you take not to eat your grandparents? And they said, what do you mean, not to eat our grandparents? That is the greatest honor we can pay them. When they get old, we bang them in the head and cook them up and eat them, and that way they're always part of us. Well, then he called in a group of Greeks, and he said, how much would you take to eat your grandparents? Nothing. What an outrageous thing. It is absolutely wrong to eat your grandparents. So there you are, Dad. It just depends upon your circumstances. That is a terrible thing. I'm wasting my money on you. No, Dad. Just ponder that. Circumstances determine all events, and they even determine how we perceive the divine world. And Euripides, the playwright, was profoundly influenced by these currents. And his plays, again and again, question traditional perceptions of right and wrong, of what is normal and what is abnormal, of what is excessive. And in his very last play, he asked, what makes a god? And how do we know what a god is? He wrote that last play out of Athens, on the banks of the lake near the capital of Pella in Macedonia. These Athenian playwrights were men of great ambition. Aeschylus himself, that we looked at last hour, died in Sicily, where he had gone to get a higher salary. Died, as a matter of fact, when an eagle dropped a turtle on his head. He had a very shiny head. He was bald, and they thought it was a rock and dropped the turtle down on it, and it killed him. But anyway, that's how he died. And Euripides had gone to Macedonia for a very high salary from the king of Macedonia. But there he wrote the Bacchae, which was then produced by his son in Athens. The play opens, this play that was written in 406 B.C., and is in fact the last of the great Athenian tragedies, because the golden age, the creative age of Athenian tragedy, was absolutely coterminous with the period from the Battle of Marathon to the defeat of Athens in the Great War against the Spartans. In other words, it was coterminous with the golden age of the Athenian democracy. So the play was composed in 406, probably produced in 405, and it opens in the city of Thebes, the same city where Oedipus had once lived. And the opening scene has the god Dionysus. In fact, the god in whose honor all of these tragedies are put on, standing there and addressing the audience. But he looks very much like a handsome stranger. And he tells the audience his story. I am indeed the god, Dionysus, the son of Zeus. I was born right here in Thebes. My mother was a mortal, Semele. And Zeus came to her in all his glory, and she conceived me. And she wanted to see Zeus in his absolute majesty, so he became a thunderbolt and destroyed her. But before he destroyed her, I untimely was ripped from her womb. And the wife of Zeus, Hera, outraged at one more of his infidelities, demanded that I be destroyed. And as always, clever and deceitful, my father Zeus hid me in his thigh. He stitched me up in it. And Hera thought I was dead. But when I grew and was able to take care of myself, he brought me forth from his thigh. So I am the son of God by a mortal woman. Do you understand that? And I was literally brought back from the dead, being snatched out of his thigh. And I grew up and traveled far, all the way out to India. And now I have come back to Greece, having traversed the plains of Persia, having traversed the land of the Thracians. And I have come now to bring my worship to Greece. And I want to start it right here in my hometown of Thebes. And already I have won many adherents. The women of Thebes have flocked and joined my band of merrymakers. For my religion is a religion of joy. My merrymakers drink wine. They feast. They roam the countryside. Yes, they even carry out promiscuous sexual acts, but all in my devotion, beating the cymbals, the panthers, the lions, all subject to my rule. I ride in a mighty chariot. But I want to test my home city. I want to test the wisdom of its ruler, Pentheus. Pentheus, the name literally means man of sorrows. Pentheus. And he is now king over Thebes. My grandfather, his grandfather as well, Cadmus, has abdicated the throne and turned it over. And I want to test Pentheus to see if in his wisdom he will recognize me for the god that I am. Thus I'll appear to him only as a handsome stranger. But already the mystery and mystique and fervor of the worship of Dionysus has swept through the city. And the aged grandfather, Cadmus, comes out and says, "This is but a celebration, a glory." And he's dressed up like a Dionysiac worshiper with ivy wreaths in his hair, carrying the pine cone-tipped staff, the thyrsus, dressed like a young man, though he's old. And out comes the old blind soothsayer, Tiresias, remember, who met with Oedipus and gave him the desperate news. Tiresias is there, grown young again. "Let us go, old Cadmus, and worship this god. Let us join with the women and roam through the hills all around Thebes. Ahoy, ahoy, ahoy! The god comes. Ahoy, ahoy, ahoy! The god comes." Yes, we've grown young again, and when you're in the worship of the god, you can never look foolish. "Let us go, old chap." Pentheus arrives on the scene and says, "What in the world is going on? I have reports of absolute disorder in the city that I must govern. I hear my own mother is out roaming the woods with this bunch of promiscuous women, doing all sorts of deeds, dishonoring their husbands' beds. What is going on?" "Oh, we worship the god Dionysus." "You worship what god? Dionysus? There is no such god." "No, no, 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 no. Don't you know? In fact, he was born right here. Semele, your relative, was his mother." "That is all a lie. Semele got pregnant out of wedlock, and Cadmus blew her up so that the disgrace would be hidden." "No, no, no, that's not it at all." "Yes, it is. There is no such thing as Dionysus. Where are you getting these notions?" "Well, there's this handsome stranger here that seems to know all about Dionysus and is his priest. I want to meet that man." "You wanted to meet me? Where'd you come from? You said you wanted to meet the stranger. I'm the stranger." "Well, you're good looking enough, I'll admit that, but what do you have to do with all of these rites? They worship the god Dionysus. Do you not know his story? He was born right here in Thebes." "No, he wasn't. That's just a lie." "I don't know if I would be that quick to say something is a lie. Do you have convincing proof that it's not the truth?" "It's just nonsense. And all you are is some manipulative charlatan. And you are leading these women astray just to seduce them. And you are causing all kinds of immorality in a city that I am determined is going to be a moral, upright city. Again, I don't know if I would say that, King Pentheus, if I were not absolutely certain. And I don't see how you, a mortal, a human, can be certain about what the gods are or what the gods wish or will. There's much danger in that. No, there is much danger in my allowing my city to be disrupted. Now, I'm putting you under arrest. Well, all right, arrest me. All right, put him in irons. Let's take him off to the prison. Next scene, there is the handsome stranger standing around again that we know is Dionysus, that Pentheus doesn't, standing around. Says, look at old Pentheus over there. He's got this big bull and he's trying to put handcuffs on him. He thinks it's me. I've totally transformed his brain. And he thinks he's putting the stranger into prison. Hi, Pentheus. I've got you chained up over there. Oh, do you? How did you get loose? I don't know. Maybe we can't trust our eyes on everything. Maybe we have to believe sometime. This is all getting very strange to me, says Pentheus. Yes, well, perhaps if you would just listen to me, I could help you learn a little bit more about this stranger, Dionysus. Because, you know, I think you're on to something. I think probably it is just a charlatan. Ah, I knew I was right. Yes, and I have to admit I've been on to this as well. And what I think we ought to do is just come out in the open and say that he's seducing these women and that all of this is just a wild excuse for immorality. But, you know, you've got to get inside them, Pentheus. Yes? Yes, what you've got to do is really see these nocturnal rites that they carry out when they meet on the high mountaintops under the cover of darkness and carry out all these deeds. Yeah, well, how could I do that, says Pentheus. And the stranger says, well, why don't I dress you up just a little bit like one of these worshippers? Really? Do you think that would be a seemly thing for a king to do? Of course it would. Put on this ivy wreath. Put on this loose-fitting gown. Yes, yes. How do I look in it? Oh, you look quite nice. One of the ringlets of your hair has come out. Let's put it back. Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. And how do I carry the thyrsus, the pine cone tips staff? Well, carry it in your right hand like this and then shout, ahoy! 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 That's the way. That's the way. Oh, you look just like one. Come on, let's go up on the mountain there, King Pentheus, and let's see where they're all sporting. I can't quite see. They're over that hill there. You know, you need to be on a high point, King Pentheus. Yes, you need a vantage point. How about this? And suddenly, the stranger pulls down a mighty pine tree, just bends it down to the ground. Hop on that. Puts Pentheus on it and lets it fly up. And there's Pentheus suddenly up on top of the pine tree, looking out. And the next scene, we have shifted back to the palace, and the messenger comes in. Oh, that I must never describe something like this. Oh, the horror of what happened. And old Cadmus comes out. What happened? It's your grandson. What happened to him? It's terrible. He was up on top of this pine tree. And the women, those who are celebrating the rites of Bacchus, Bacchus, the same as Dionysus, the Bacchae, they came rushing up and they saw him up there. And in their moral hysteria, in their blindness, they thought he was a mountain lion. And they hurled themselves on that tree and began to shake it like this. Began to shake it and shake it and shake it. And his mother was one of them. His mother was one of them, yes. And she thought he was a mountain lion, and they shook it and shook it and shook it, and he fell down, and then they leapt upon him and tore him into pieces. They tore Pentheus into pieces? Yes, in their mad fury. They tore him into pieces. And suddenly the line of the women worshippers of Bacchus, the other name for Dionysus, the Bacchae, they appear, shouting with glory, well, we are mighty warriors. The God has given us the strength to overcome vicious beast. Look what I have brought to you, old aged father. The head of a mountain lion. Stick it up on the mantelpiece. Stick it over our fireplace. Put it over the doorpost. Don't you see what that is? What? It's a and suddenly the god takes away her blindness, and she holds in her hand the dripping, bloody head of her child, the blood dripping down from the severed neck.
Oh, it's Pentheus. It's my child. He's dead. How did he die?
You killed him. You and the other Bacchae, you tore him into pieces.
No, I wouldn't tear my own child into pieces. You tore him into pieces.
And now, says aged Cadmus, I must go out and find the other pieces so that we can give him a burial of some kind. And so the old man ranges over the mountains, pulling a piece here, an arm here, a leg here, a toe there, a piece of the torso from there, until poor Pentheus, the man of sorrows, is brought together. Now Dionysus appears in all his majesty. Now let no one doubt that I am a god. And you, for all of your hostility to me, Thebes, you will pay a punishment. And you, aged man Cadmus, despite your worship of me, you must suffer. You and your wife will be turned into beast, to dragon, and to a serpent, and you will wander the world in exile, suffering pain and torture and punishment, lest anyone ever doubt that I am God, that I am Dionysus. The last words were of the chorus. Let no mortal think that he is so wise that he can discern what God is, for the divine comes in many forms, and wise is that man who allows his eyes to see the truth. And once again, wisdom only comes through suffering. And so the play, the Bacchae, comes to its end. And Pentheus has truly been the man of sorrows, who in his hubris, his outrageous arrogance, thinking that he knew what was divine, brought this destruction not only upon himself, but upon the whole of Thebes. The Bacchae embodies for us the deeper meaning of Greek tragedy. The tragedy most certainly had a political purpose. Its purpose was to allow the Athenians to debate fundamental questions, placing these great dramas back into a distant mythological past, such as the time of the Trojan War, the time of Cadmus, so that we would understand that these are universal, eternal questions that every generation must deal with. And Euripides himself had written some profoundly political plays. In our course on famous Greeks, we looked at his Trojan Women, which so many believe to be a pacifist play, which I, in fact, showed you was a play of a patriot determined that Athens would carry out a preemptive strike against Sicily. He had frequently entered into the political fray with his dramas. But this time, at the end of his life, he has stepped back and asked you to deal with far more profound questions. Now that Athens was on the very brink of absolute defeat, there are things more enduring, more significant than politics, Euripides says. And it is, after having spent my whole life in quest of it, what is God? And what mortal can decide, can say absolutely, this is divine? Dionysus was the god to whom these plays were dedicated. Every one of these tragic performances was a religious festival in honor of the god Dionysus. Who is Dionysus? Well, he's told us something about himself in his introductory speech. He is the son of Zeus by a mortal woman who suffered and in one form of his legend even died. In one form of his legend, known to the Athenians, Hera had him destroyed by the giants, blown to pieces, and Zeus put him back together. So he is the son of God by a mortal woman who has suffered, even died, and been brought back to life by his Father. He is indeed the God of wine, but let's not just put that aside too quickly. What is wine? Wine is the vines, if you've ever seen them in the spring, in the late winter, they are all cut back. You ever seen a vineyard in the late winter? It's all cut back almost to nothing. And then, in March of the year, when these plays are put on, it suddenly comes back to life. Now, to us who go to the giant supermarket and buy our grapes and so on, I mean, they're there all year round. They're not from California, they're from Chile or somewhere like that. But no, not in the agricultural society of classical Greece. That is a miracle that happens every year, this eternal reoccurrence. And the vines come back, and they grow, and they flourish. And then you pick the grape. And how do you make it into wine? You must crush it. It then bleeds. Its juice pours out. And then it gives you this life-giving fluid. And in the play, the Bacchae, old Cadmus and Tiresias talk about the blessing that Dionysus has given us. Demeter gave us wheat to eat. Ah, but what is wheat to eat? What is bread without wine? Dionysus has now given us wine in which mortals lose all of their cares, which all the troubles of the day pass away. It is this life-giving fluid. And yet, wine itself embodies the concept of nothing in excess. Isn't that true? Drink a little bit, it's good for your stomach. I thought it was a liter. Mrs. Fears tells me a glass, whatever it is. A little bit is certainly good for you. But drink too much and you go crazy. You enter into that same kind of madness that the Bacchae had when they tore to pieces Pentheus. So nothing in excess. That is the lesson of wine as well. But there's more to Dionysus than that. For one of the most sacred and ancient rituals at Athens was the festival held every year at Eleusis, at the shrine somewhat to the north of Athens, where the Athenians as a civic body went and offered up their sacrifices and prayed to the goddess Demeter, to her daughter Persephone, remember, who had been snatched away by the god of the underworld, kept in the underworld for 6 months, and then 6 months of the year by the ransoming of her mother, got to flourish in the upper world. The symbol of the death of the crops in the winter, and their coming back. Once again, this immortal ritual. And joined with them in worship was the god Dionysus. For indeed, if you partook of the sacred meal in honor of Dionysus and Demeter, if you proclaimed your belief in their power, if you underwent a sacred baptism to wash away your old life, then the Athenians believed you never died, but had eternal life. So the Son of God, by a mortal woman, who suffered and died and came back to life, can give you everlasting life and can give you the wisdom to understand that divine power. For ultimately the purpose of the Greek play, the Bacchae, as it was for the Orestes, as it was for Oedipus, is to give you the wisdom to live your life by. And what did I tell you at the close of the Orestia? We only learn wisdom through suffering. That is what Aeschylus tells you in the play. We only learn wisdom through suffering. You are not going to learn it by listening to this teaching company course. You'll listen, you'll enjoy it, but you are not going to become wise unless you suffer. That is why every generation has to repeat the same mistakes. That's why you have to tell your child, look, I know what I'm talking about, don't do this, and they're always going to go ahead and do it. But the Athenian drama, the Bacchae, like the Orestia, gives you the chance to learn by the suffering of someone else. Look on that stage. Look at Pentheus. And learn from his vicarious suffering. Learn that you are not wise enough to know everything about the world of the divine. Know that the divine power comes in many ways and many forms of recognizing good. Learn from that vicarious sacrifice For that is what Pentheus, the man of sorrows, is, a vicarious sacrifice to teach you wisdom and to teach you that you are not fated to make these mistakes. You make them out of your own moral blindness. Alinon, alinon, de pe, kaidu nikito, kaidu nikito. The Oresteia, we are told, sing, sorrow, sing, but good will win out in the end. And that is the ultimate message of every Greek drama. There is sorrow, as the sorrow that came upon Pentheus, but the ultimate is the good of Dionysus.